Okay, good morning, everybody. So I will be discussing today some work that we have been doing on modeling the adaptation of populations, mostly asexual, but in the end I also talk a little bit about the effect of recombination. So this talk has sort of three parts, and the first part is by far the biggest one. So I will hope to at least, you know, given that it's not never clear how much material one can really cover in these talks, I hope to definitely to get through with this one. After this, we can take a break, and then these two pieces are much shorter. So I think that would be nice to sort of wrap it up talking about these more recent things. And this is work with my postdoc Soo-Chun Park and with Arjan de Visser from the University of Wageningen in Holland. And so the kind of things that we're thinking about are actually very classic topics in population genetics. And the theme, in some sense, these pictures that I'm going to show you here come from a very influential paper by Crow and Kimura from 1965, and they sort of set the theme for this talk. So I think it's sort of important that you understand what these pictures mean. And this is an illustration of what is known as the Muller-Fisher mechanism for the advantage of sex, or rather the advantage of recombination. So this is one of the topics, of course, that people have thought about since the 1930s, what is the evolutionary advantage of recombination? And this is one idea that was formulated verbally by Muller and Fisher in the 1930s, and the first sort of quantitative treatment is due to Crow and Kimura. So this is the picture. So we're thinking about a population that is adapting to a new environment, and it does so by producing beneficial mutations, which now are adaptive in this new environment. And the question is, what is sort of the dynamics of the appearance of these beneficial mutations? And this first picture shows a small population evolving either asexually or sexually. And so what happens is that it takes a long time for this beneficial mutation to appear. So the beneficial mutations are rare. And then this beneficial mutation spreads in the population. Another long period of time passes, and then a second mutation appears, and so on. And so this is a regime of small populations where mutations, these beneficial mutations, are rare and essentially independent. So they appear one after another. And this is a regime that in some of the literature at least is called periodic selection. Of course, it's not really periodic, it's random. This is a Poisson process, but the point is that these selective events are well separated and independent. Now, as you make the population larger, obviously you will have more beneficial mutations occurring because there are some beneficial mutation rate per individual. So as you make the population bigger or increase the mutation rate, the picture will change and you will start having interference or competition between different clones. So this is what I will call clonal interference in the broadest sense. So here for the asexual population, this means, for example, that this mutation A appears first, and then there's a mutation B and a mutation C that appear also, but they don't have any chance of spreading in the population. They are outcompeted by A, and so they are lost. And so in order to incorporate these mutations B and C, they have to appear again. So here, for example, mutation B now appears in the ancestry of mutation A, and so after a while you'll have individuals which have both A and B. C appears once again here, but is again outcompeted, and finally here C also is incorporated. I didn't really say what these pictures mean, but I hope they are intuitive enough. So this line here is just this axis shows the composition of the population. So the white is sort of the initial. Here we have the mutant population, individuals with mutant A, mutant AB, and so on, and this is time. So this is how these pictures are supposed to be read. So this is what happens in the asexual case. So these new mutations can become fixed or can become spread in the population only if they occur in the ancestry of mutation A. Whereas in the sexual population, things are different. In the sexual population, you have A, B, and C appearing here, but then through recombination, you can create individuals which have A and C and A and B, and you see that there is a big advantage because the sexual population has now acquired these three beneficial mutations at a much shorter time than the asexual population. Okay, so this is sort of the essence of the argument as it was formulated by Muller. And so in some sense, the task is now to quantify this picture. Okay, so we want to have a theory which tells us something about the speed of adaptation in this case, and this was already attempted by Crow and Kimura, and also Maynard Smith did some work on this in the early 70s, but the topic has sort of been revived again in recent years, partly because there are now experiments on microbial populations where in some sense these ideas can be tested more quantitatively. So you can vary things like population size and mutation rate in a controlled manner, and you can check whether this picture is really correct or not and what we can learn from it. So that's sort of the general theme. So I will mostly, in the first part of the talk, I will be discussing this scenario here, and at the end I will discuss a little bit to what extent this advantage of sexual reproduction is really there if you look at fitness models which are realistic, which are sort of derived from actual experiments. Okay, so is this pretty much clear? Okay, so we want to develop a kind of quantitative description of this, so we need a model. And the model that I will be using was introduced already in the tutorial talks last week. So this is a Wright-Fisher model. We have a population of constant size n. We have a discrete time. So time is in discrete, non-overlapping generations. So in each generation, the population sort of dies out and is recreated. And the way it's recreated is that each individual in the new generation has to choose one ancestor in the preceding generation. So this is at this point without any sex. It's everybody has just one parent. This is not what we were hearing about last week. Was mostly the neutral Wright-Fisher model, where there are no fitness differences between individuals. But here, since we're talking about adaptation, it's obviously important to have fitness differences. So each individual is assigned a fitness, which is a function of this individual's genotype. And the way the fitness enters the model is that the probability of being chosen as a parent in this process is just proportional to the fitness. So this fitness is essentially a measure of the mean number or the expected number of offspring of a given individual. So this is some number WI, also I'll discuss later how to assign it. And then there are also mutations, which means that in this reproduction process, the genotype can change. So in this figure, the different genotypes are labeled with different colors. And so you see here this green genotype, which appears and then dies out again. And you see here this red genotype, which eventually takes over the whole population. And so this is a very important process, this process of a genotype appearing in one individual and then spreading throughout the population. And this is called fixation. And this is something that we will be a concept that will play an important role in the following, so I want to go into it a little bit. So if you don't have any mutations in this model, it's fairly obvious that if you introduce a single mutant, there are only two things that can happen asymptotically for a long time. Either this mutant will take over the population, that is all everybody has then the new genotype, or it gets lost. So there's either fixation or loss of this mutation. And you can ask, what is the probability for either of these outcomes? This probability obviously depends on the fitness. And there is an expression which was derived by Kimura. It's an approximate expression for the Wright-Fisher model. For this fixation probability, which is given by this expression. So it depends on the selection coefficient. So the selection coefficient is, in this setting, the relative fitness minus 1. So it's positive if the new genotype is better, and it's negative if it's worse. So it's beneficial for S bigger than 1 and deleterious for S smaller than 1. And here S appears together with N, so there is a notion of strong selection, which means that N times S is large compared to 1, which is what we're typically going to assume. And in that case, you can basically get rid of this denominator, and the fixation probability becomes this. And then on the other hand, S is typically small compared to 1, so in many cases people just assume that this fixation probability is 2S. Okay, so it's just proportional to the selection coefficient. Another quantity that we will be needing is the time that it takes for a beneficial mutation to fix, if it's going to be fixed, which is of the order of log n divided by s. So I think I'll just write down these two formulas here so that we can sort of remember them. Okay, so this is sort of these are the main properties of this elementary fixation event that we will be needing. Now, I still haven't told you how to assign the fitness. So again, this is something that we heard about last week. So in this part of the talk, at least, I will be working in the infinite sites approximation or infinite number of sites approximation. So the idea is that the genome is of infinite length, which means that each mutation creates a new genotype. There are no recurrent mutations, so no mutation occurs twice. And the way we assign these fitnesses to these mutants is in a multiplicative way. So if I have an offspring with fitness W prime, then its fitness is the fitness of the parent times 1 plus s. Okay, so this means in some sense that the mutations are independent. So the population genetic term for this is that there is no epistasis, there are no interactions between different mutations, and I'm going to discuss in the second part of the talk a little bit what epistasis actually does in this context. But for now, we're just assuming that these mutations are all independent, so I just multiply the parental fitness with this 1 plus s, and this s is now it's supposed to be a different one for every mutation that occurs, so we'll choose it from a distribution P of s. Okay? Now, here, and this is again something that came up actually in the very, very first discussion last Tuesday, of course, the big question is, what is this distribution P of S? So if you want this model to be somehow realistic, what should you choose for P of S? And there's a kind of convention in the field, which goes back to a very influential paper by Orr, which is that as long as you're thinking about beneficial mutations, which are the important ones here, this distribution should be exponential, and this is—it's a kind of extremal statistics argument, which says that populations that are viable are already very well adapted, and therefore, whatever the sort of space of fitnesses is, or whatever the true distribution of fitnesses is, they are likely to be in the tail. Okay, so they are in the tail, and from extremal statistics, one knows that the tails of at least a large class of probability distributions looks exponential. So this is sort of the argument. I don't want you to necessarily believe this, but this is what we're going to use in most of the work, and I will discuss to some extent the influence of this choice. So there have been other choices as well, and so we can discuss a little bit what this really means.
I mean, even if you're going to discuss it, I mean, think there's two problems intrinsically with this argument. I mean, the main one is, if I think of it, it's going up mountains, is that, and I look at the distribution of other peaks that are higher than the peak that you're climbing, then I think it's a good argument that distribution may sort of generically be exponential, something like it. But the problem is you're restricted to taking steps which are nearby mutationally, and so there's no particular reason why you should have a distribution like this. The other reason is that, especially if things are roughly independent, or the fitness is multiplicative or additive, whatever you want to call it, that then you very quickly deplete the ones with larger s, and you no longer have this exponential form. So I guess I'm sort of wondering why people use this form in particular. I guess why you would use
okay.
This form. It is a rather special form.
I think what you're saying is, of course, completely right. And I think in some sense, of course, there is a big problem already with this model. Okay, and I think once you start about thinking about a fitness landscape, obviously you will eventually deplete the good mutations. And of course, it's also known from experiments that the rate of adaptation is actually not constant, but it tends to slow down. So eventually, as you really go into the tail, in fact, the probability of even finding beneficial mutations will go down. So this is sort of something that I want to get back to in the second part.
But I guess so
this is sort of restricted to some particular regime where you're not feeling this limitation on the supply.
But even without the depletion, so the basic problem is that these are extrema, which are, it's a very non-local
yes,
argument.
Yes, extrema yes.
Genotypes, which are very different than the one
right.
We've got.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So it seems to me that's.
Yeah, but
the more intrinsic difficulty with it.
Right, but I think there are some. So as I said, I don't want to make a strong argument. The reason why we chose it is essentially because we didn't want to get into trouble with the community, right? So we basically choose what most people choose, And since we're not biologists, we didn't really know better. But certainly, I think it's sort of an interesting scientific question is, of course, you know, what is a good choice for this, and what can you actually learn about this distribution, for example, from experiments? And that's something that I want to get into a little bit. So I think, you know, for now, let's just think about this distribution as something that is as a kind of input into the model, and this is just one choice that is reasonable, but I don't want to be, you know, too dogmatic about it.
Let me ask you a related question. I'm assuming your SB is going to be quite small compared to one, which means that this, for a few mutations, looks like an additive process rather than a multiplicative process. So in that case, if you ask what's the way to get from a certain fitness to a higher fitness, you could do it in one very good mutation or a series of small mutations.
Yes.
And with this exponential distribution, if UB is also small, it becomes more likely to do it with one very rare mutation.
This is, a very good comment. I mean, these are sort of two regimes that you can think about. The picture seems to be that depending on your choice of the distribution, you'll sort of have either one case or the other. I don't think the scale of SB necessarily really matters that much. But
actually, the borderline is like e to the minus square root of S.
We'll get to that. Okay, but you know, to begin with, just maybe, you know, so what is sort of known experimentally about fitness distribution? So this is, I think Marty drew a kind of picture on the blackboard last week, which looked pretty much like this. So this is sort of what people think fitness distributions, not distributions of selection coefficients, but fitness distributions look like. So these are data. This is a recent review article, 2007, that addresses this issue of what do we know about the distribution of new mutations. And these are some data from a virus. And so fitness one means in this case neutral. Okay, so these are the neutral ones where the fitness it hasn't changed. So you see that most of the stuff is deleterious. So all of these are deleterious. These have fitness zero, so they are lethal. So about 40% of these viruses are not viable after the mutation. And then there's a little bit of beneficial stuff here. So essentially, when we talk about beneficial mutations, this is sort of what we're talking about. Okay, and of course, you know, looking at this picture, it would be hard pressed to say whether this is an exponential or not. I mean, it's just one point. So this is sort of what you should. So for the moment, you know, what is sort of important for this model is, in some sense, the tail over here, and this is what we need to put into the model. Now, there is one more thing which is important to keep in mind. So there is this fixation probability. Now, it turns out if you look at the process by which a mutation fixes in a population, so it appears in one individual, then of course initially the evolution is very stochastic, so it will go to 2 or maybe it goes to 0 and dies out again, or it acquires a certain size and then it comes back to 0. So there's a stochastic regime. On the other hand, once the mutation has acquired a certain size, so think about n being very big, so n is 10 to the 9, so by the time you have, say, 1,000 mutants, fluctuations will be small, and from then on you can assume that the mutation just grows exponentially. So if the mutation gets, so if S is small, you see that although the mutation is beneficial, the probability that it will get lost is rather high. But if it gets lost, it gets lost in this early regime, in the stochastic regime. So essentially, it's sort of, again, customary in this field to make a distinction between the mutations that appear in the population and those that have a chance of going to fixation that reach this sort of macroscopic level, and they will be calling them contending mutations. So they are sort of the ones that enter this exponential growth regime, and essentially the probability to become a contender is just the fixation probability 2s. So this means that if you look at, instead of looking at all mutations, so this is now the probability distribution of all mutations, which is an exponential, you should really only look at the contending ones. And since the probability of being a contender is proportional to S, this means that you have to multiply this distribution with S, and then you get something here that it's probably hard to see because of the color. But it's a distribution that now that goes to zero here and has this exponential tail. So it's essentially S times e to the minus S. So this is sort of the distribution of those mutations that really enter the game in some sense. Okay, so that's sort of the first modification of this bare mutation distribution that we put into the model.
So this would again be for strong selection.
It's always strong selection. So the strong selection we're always assuming, yes.
Because in the absence of any interference already, any mutation.
Yes.
That we see would become fixed.
Yes, yes. So the, of course, for very small s of order 1 over n, something else happens. But that we're not discussing. Okay. So now at this point we can at least formulate a kind of quantitative condition for clonal interference. This is a timescale argument, which again essentially goes back to Maynard Smith. So we have two timescales in the problem. We have one timescale at which these contending mutations arise. So there are n times UB mutations that appear in the population per generation. And the probability that they survive genetic drift is 2SB. So this is the rate at which contending mutations arise. And the inverse of that is the time between contending mutations. Now the other timescale is this fixation time here, which is log n over s. So, which, you know, for our distribution in order of magnitude, this S will be SB. So in order of magnitude, this is the fixation time. So you see, of course, that as you increase the population size, the balance between these two timescales will change. So when the population is small, the fixation time is much shorter than the mutation time. And so the picture is that you have, you know, one fixation event, then another, and then another. So this is periodic selection. And in that regime, it's easy to estimate what the rate of adaptation should be, because it's just in each of these fixation events, the fitness increases on average by 2SB. Because this is the mean of the distribution of contending mutations. So the rate of adaptation is 2SB time divided by T mute times is this rate of the mutation. So you get something that is proportional to the square of the selection coefficient times N times U. So this is, in this regime, the rate of adaptation is linear both in the population size and in the mutation probability. On the other hand, as you increase the population, this rate will increase, and the fixation time will go down. So at some point, the mutation time will be small compared to the fixation time, and this is the point at which these mutations start to interfere. And if you just plug in the numbers, you see that the condition for this is something like NUB log N being large compared to 1. So the S actually drops out. And this tells you that even if UB is small, if N becomes sufficiently large, you will enter this regime where there is interference, provided that the rate of beneficial mutations is indeed constant, which on large timescales it's not, because the population is sort of running out of good mutations. But this is something that I will get into later. Okay, so this is the criterion. So as you make N bigger, the mutations will start to interact, and you'll get into this new regime. And so the question is, what is the rate of adaptation in this new regime? Okay.
Just a comment, because I'm sure you're sort of going to say it directly, but I think it's useful at this point. That for microbial populations, log n is often a large factor.
So yes. Yes.
Here, yeah.
Yes. 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 Yeah. Okay. So this is just illustrating this. So I'm going to show a number of simulation data for the Wright-Fisher model, and there's sort of a standard set of parameters that we are using. So the only parameter that I'm varying is n. So the beneficial mutation rate is 10 to the minus 6, and SB is 0.02. And so here these pictures illustrate. So the red line is always the population fraction of the most populated genotype, the green line is a population fraction of the second most populated, and there's a blue, and so on. So these are the further frequencies. And so you see here, this is 10 to the 4. Here you see this periodic selection regime. So there's one event where the currently dominating genotype is replaced by another. Here's another one, here's another one. But you basically never see more than two genotypes at once. So this is periodic selection. Now, as you increase population size to 10 to the 5, you start seeing some more stuff here, and you also see that these genotypes never really reach fixation, so they don't reach frequency 1. And as you increase the population size further, things get more and more complicated, and so you have more and more genotypes entering. So this is sort of the dynamical picture of what is going on as you increase n. Okay, so this is sort of what you should have in mind. Okay, so now how can we describe this rate of adaptation? So there is a simple theory that was formulated by Gerrish and Lenski about 10 years ago. And this is a kind of, it's a simple argument, and the picture is essentially the following. So let me maybe just go back to this picture here. So we have, we're generating these contending mutations, okay? So there's some process in time which generates contending mutations, and as we make the population size bigger, the rate of this process becomes larger and larger. And now Gerrish and Lenski say, well, due to a clonal interference, a lot of these beneficial mutations will be lost. They will be outcompeted by something that comes later but has higher fitness. And so basically the idea is that you sort of dilute this process. So you just take out all the mutations that will be outcompeted. And the criterion for this is very simple. You just say a contending mutation survives if there is no superior mutation that arises during the time of fixation of S. Okay, so you just look at all these mutations. So you look at, this is a given mutation, you look at its fixation time, and you ask, what is the probability that during this time no superior mutation comes along? So this is a kind of an argument that really doesn't take into account the competition. It's just sort of diluting this set of mutations according to this criteria. And this is, and so you can do a simple calculation. You can just ask, what is the probability that a mutation survives clonal competition in this sense? So you just have to write, so because they are generated according to a Poisson process, the survival probability is e to the minus lambda, and lambda is just the number of mutations that arise during the fixation process, which is n times u times t fix, multiplied by the probability that they are that their fitness is bigger than S. Okay, so this is a probability that there will be an interfering mutation that comes along as a function of S. So this is a probability that you have a contending mutation with a selection coefficient bigger than S. And so this you can plug in the expression that I've been using, so you get some integral. And this you just have to calculate. And in principle, you can do this, of course, for any fitness distribution, and you can do it also for general expressions for the fixation probability. So this is sort of the idea.
So just a question about factors of two in this expression. As the thing is getting fixed, then for half the period of fixation, it's this mutation, this S, is less is not the dominant one, but then later it becomes the dominant one.
Yes.
And further S prime might occur within the same.
Okay, so this is sort of one. I mean, probably the most severe approximation here is that there are no mutations occurring in the offspring of this mutation while it's going to fixation. Of course, you're completely right that, you know, but in the beginning it will be a minority, but eventually it will be a majority. So the probability that a new mutation occurs is in fact bigger inside the clone than outside of the clone. But this is sort of ignored. Okay, so we're really just looking at the mutations that occur on the wild type background, and we're just picking out those which satisfy this criterion.
But there's something else which is ignored as well. So even just by fiat, you say that there's no mutations that arise within the growing clone. You still, the second mutation that arises still has to catch up with the first one and beat it out. It can't just be bigger.
Yes.
And that already changes its answer.
Yes. So the other, so there's sort of two approximations involved. One is that these multiple mutations, that is, beneficial mutations arising within a clone, are ignored. And the second one is that, as you say, that when a beneficial mutation arises, it's actually not competing against the wild type, but it's competing against the population which already has this clone in it. So it's actually more difficult for it to come up. But and to some extent, these two these two approximation actually cancel. So, you know, this is, as I said, this is an extremely simplified picture. But, I mean, one of the messages of this talk, which you might not like, is that this actually works much better than you would expect. Okay, so it's okay, so we'll get to that. But this is the idea. And so what does this do? So this sort of culls out most of the mutations of small effect, because in order to survive, in order to satisfy this criterion, this distribution, of course, goes to one. This survival probability goes to one when S becomes very large. So the mutations of big effect are more likely to survive clonal interference. On the other hand, of course, the rate at which these occur is much smaller than the rate at which all mutations occur. So the qualitatively, what you expect this to do is that it reduces the rate of substitution. So it reduces, of course, the rate at which these fixation events really take place, but it increases the effect of each mutation. Okay, so that's sort of the qualitative picture, and this is illustrated here. This is a graph from a paper by these people. So this sort of summarizes what we have been discussing so far. So we start out from some strange unknown fitness distribution, which has a lot of deleterious stuff, and there is this little piece here which is beneficial. Then we say, well, this beneficial part we can model by something like this, which looks like an exponential. So that's the only thing that we're going to care about. Then we introduce these contending mutations, which makes this distribution into that. Okay, and now clonal interference comes along. And so what clonal interference does is that it only allows those mutations to survive that are of large effect, which means that this distribution is now shifted to the right. Okay, so as you increase n, of course, clonal interference becomes more severe. So this distribution is somehow going to be shifted to the right, and presumably it's also going to change in width. Okay, so that's sort of the picture. And again, let me sort of illustrate this with a simulation. So this is the distribution of mutations that go to fixation as a function of n up to 10 to the 9. And so you see for the smallest one, this is the red line here is this distribution of contending mutations, just s times the exponential. And as you make n bigger, the distribution sort of wanders to the right. Okay, so this is sort of qualitatively the effect what happens. And again, so the question is, do you actually see that in experiments? So this is a picture from a recent science paper by Perfetto and Gordo and collaborators. And so these are based on experiments using E. coli. So essentially all the experimental plots that I'm going to show you are from experiments with E. coli. And so here you see measured distributions of selection coefficients for two different population sizes, 2 times 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 7. And you see there are sort of two sets of bars. There's one set which looks rather regular. That's the fit to a function. And there's one set that is less regular. The dark bars are the actual experimental data. And you see, you can sort of see that for the larger n gives you a distribution that goes further out to the right. Although the picture is not that clear, but there is a suppression here, and so there's a suppression of mutations of small effect and an increase of mutations of large effect.
So what medium is this in? Is it E. coli under what conditions?
I don't know.
But, you know, are they keeping it in exponential growth in log phase, or are they letting it go diluting it once a day? Or
I don't know. That I can't tell you.
Because you tend to get very different behavior once if you don't strictly keep it in log. In log phase.
I think there is a kind of standard protocol that basically all these groups are using, but I can't really tell you. What I can tell you is that the way these mutations are sort of identified is through these microsatellite techniques. So there are these microsatellites. So you have a sort of a number of the different parts of the population are contain different numbers of microsatellites at a certain locus, and so that's the way you sort of distinguish them. And so if you see in one of the subpopulations something coming up, something growing, you can detect a selection coefficient. So I have one slide just illustrating in principle how this, you know, how you measure selection coefficients in this, in these experiments. And this is from a paper of this is a group in Harvard, again on E. coli. I'll get back to that work a little bit later. So, but essentially the idea is always that you have to somehow put markers into your population, right? So you want to put in markers that allow you to distinguish different individuals. In this case, they just have a color marker, so there are two colors in the population. And now if there is a mutation, a beneficial mutation arising in the yellow subpopulation, you'll see that the yellow population is growing at the expense of the blue one, and so that allows you to pick off a selection coefficient here. And if then later a beneficial mutation arises in the blue population, this line goes down again, so you have a slope here. So essentially you're sort of looking at these kinds of trajectories and you're picking out these slopes.
Okay. How does one know those are single mutations rather than multiple?
Well, you don't, of course.
So I think for these population parameters, there's a good chance that they're really multiple things and the data won't look that different. These
of course, yeah, there are lots of things that you can miss. I mean, for example, also if it's, you know, if the line is straight, it might be that you have two mutations of comparable effect in the two subpopulations. You're obviously missing a lot of things. Now, in the Perfetto-Gordo experiment, they have sort of more markers, so they are subdividing the population into more pieces, which allows them to pick out more. But of course, it's still clear that you're sort of missing a lot of stuff. I mean, it's so, you know, these data are not, of course, not as good as you would like them to be.
If I remember correctly, this was in fact the main difficulty in that experiment, to get the right number. So you get these fitness effects, but what exactly that question, whether it's one or two or three mutations, we don't know.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
And they are making an argument about that, but that was the sticky point of view in this experiment.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Who's the senior author on this?
Shimoni. No.
Shoni's? This is Kishoni's?
It's
Kishoni. Kishoni, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, so it's somewhat different at the early stages of evolution than it is later on. So this is, these data are, if I remember right, are early stages.
Yes.
We haven't built much of a distribution. And there, I think these. You're much closer to the regime where you're likely to getting single ones coming in here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they haven't got to, at all to the steady state.
Mm. No, that's well, to the extent that there is a steady state, I'm not, you know.
The size experiments in the, from the yeast suggest that there is over a substantial range. Even with very large populations, much bigger than they're using here.
Okay. Right. So let's now just try to become a little bit more quantitative. So this, you know, these experiments are of course sort of qualitatively pointing in the right direction. But I want to be now, you know, just from the point of view of theory, you would like to know how well does this really work quantitatively. And so you can, to begin with, you can just evaluate this integral that the Skerislensky theory gives you asymptotically, and so what you get are some expressions. So this is the rate of substitution, so this is the rate at which these mutations that still go to fixation appear, and so it's proportional to the selection coefficient, and it has these logs, and asymptotically it just goes to SB. And the selection coefficient of fixed mutations, the scale, of course, is again SB, but then there is this logarithmic factor. So this sort of tells you how much bigger these fixed mutations are compared to the typical ones. And so the rate of adaptation, which is just the rate of fitness increase, which in this case, because we have this multiplicative model, is log E over T, becomes SB squared times, again, such a logarithmic factor containing essentially U times N. So the main effect here is that instead of having a linear dependence on the product of population size times mutation rate, you get a logarithmic dependence. So this N times U is also called the mutation supply, so that's just the number of mutations that you have per generation, but it's very natural that it always appears in this combination. But by increasing the mutation supply, the increase in the fitness growth rate is very small, which just tells you that most of these mutations actually get lost. So that's sort of a fairly clear signature of this effect. Now,
if U E gets bigger, then the assumption gets less and less tenable, right? In the sense that, for example, this multiple mutation that you mentioned, at some point this has to be as a function of U E. Right?
As a function of U B, possibly, yeah.
I mean, there is a fact which the Kalman inference gets qualitatively wrong, and I think this is true even for the exponential distribution. Which is that if you, in this clonal interference, if you increase the mutation rate, but keep the population size constant, then you're pushing out the, because you're getting more mutations coming in, you're pushing out the distribution in such a way that the mutations that you fixed are larger than they would be at lower mutation rate. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I mean, the more detailed theory of this is that the sign of that effect is wrong. That as you increase the mutation rate, the size of the mutations you fix actually goes down rather than up.
That we haven't checked that, but I'll get to this effect just in two slides. So at this point, so the question is at this point, you know, where do these logarithms come from? So it's sort of useful to think about this in a little bit in simpler terms. So essentially, what this Gerish-Lensky theory is a kind of extremal statistics argument. So we can do the following argument. We can just extremal statistics means just that you ask what is the probability of finding a selection coefficient that is bigger than something. So, for example, bigger than capital S. So there should be a capital S here. So it's e to the minus S over SB. And now I look at some time during the process. So I look at some number of generations T, and I ask what is the largest mutation, the mutation of largest effect that will appear in that time. Okay, and so that is determined by just having this probability of being bigger than S max just being equal to 1 over the number of mutations that appeared in this time. So here I'm sort of using the full distribution rather than the contending one, but that doesn't really make much of a difference for this argument. So this tells you that the largest mutation that appears in T generations is this one. So what is the right choice for T? Well, Gerish-Lensky tells us that the choice for T should be the fixation time of that mutation itself. Okay, so S max is the mutation of largest effect that appears within its own mutation, within its own fixation time. So that gives you a self-consistency argument. So S max should be equal to this. And if you just solve for S max and you do some approximations, you end up exactly with this expression that I showed you before with the nu log n. So that's sort of the essence of the argument. That is, you look at some time scale, you pick out the largest mutation that appears within that time scale, and this is the one that will go to fixation. And then, of course, the rate of substitution is just the inverse of the relevant time scale. And again, to leading order, including most of the logs, you get the right result. So that's sort of the essence of the argument. So you just, within one fixation time, all that matters is the largest mutation that appears. And this argument, of course, you can now also apply to other distributions. And so Daniel and Michael Desai looked at a class of distributions which looks like this. So instead of having an exponential, you can look at something that decays with a kind of stretched, or what is the opposite of stretched?
Unstretched.
Compressed or exponential. So asymptotically, these estimates, of course, are extremely rough because you'll see later that when you compare to simulations, these asymptotic expressions are not very really useful. But still, to sort of get an idea, I'm focusing here just on the n dependence. So then you see that S max in general will go as log n over 1 over beta. The rate of substitution will be this because there's another log n coming from the fixation time. And so this is the rate of adaptation, which now will go as log n to the power 2 over beta minus 1. And now at this point, you could ask, is this assumption that only the largest fitness in this time matters, is that really realistic? And you have to compare it to something else. And what you can compare it to is the effect of the cumulative effect of many mutations of small effect. Okay, and this is sort of the extremal case where there are, in some sense, only mutations of typical effect is the case where this PB is a delta function. That is, there's only every mutation has the same effect as zero. And for that case, you can show that the rate of adaptation is this. And so most importantly, as a function of n, it goes as log n. And so you see that depending on this exponent beta here, this can either be bigger than that or smaller than that. And so that very roughly tells you that depending on what your fitness distribution looks like, you can either have sort of, you're either dominated by many mutations of typical effect or by these extreme mutations of large effect. And the borderline here would be beta equal to 1. So you see that the standard case, the exponential case, in some sense is actually marginal. So you wouldn't really know exactly what regime it falls into.
Let me just a comment. Firstly, I agree that the asymptotic regimes, asymptotic expressions may be useful. But in this analysis, the asymptotic expressions are exact. And they, with coefficients and the log n independences. Okay. If you put things inside log n's and so on, you can do quite a bit. You know, there's various things you can put inside. The other one is that this analysis, I think, the dependence on the mutation rate is the opposite of the dependence from the simple clone inference analysis. And if I remember correctly, that for beta equals 1, what dominates is a couple of mutations, several mutations on top of each other, not just a single one. It's a fixed number that dominates for large n rather than becoming larger and larger.
Right.
And for beta less than a half or something like that, it's only 1. I mean, there's some things which, some things change at beta equals 1, some things change at beta or a half or something like that. But it's still in some sense, the basic process and the way it goes is still somewhat different, even though the results for this marginal case are very similar. And I think it's important also for analyzing data as far as distributions, and also, and this you may come to, I mean, for the effects of mating a population as to how much diversity is driven by this process.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to be careful. I mean, in some sense, the log n or powers of log n comes out, you know, by various heuristic arguments, including this one. But one can also do the the analysis, which is at least asymptotically exact.
Right.
And in fact, one can do a lot of the intermediate regimes, exact after solving some simple integral equation and things. So it's...
What I just referred to in terms of these asymptotics not being that useful is, for example, if you look at... In the case that we have studied, the exponential case, if you look at these expressions and you compare them with the simulation data for 10 to the 9, which is a rather big population, they are still very far away. So for that case, it actually really matters that you do the whole integral of the Gerish-Lensky thing and so on. But this is of course not surprising, because we all know that having expressions, asymptotic expressions with logs of logs is not going to, because if there's a log of a log, there's also a log of a log of a log. And so on.
So they're with a wrong calculation, which is demonstrably wrong.
Well, it's the best available for this particular distribution.
No.
Yes, I think it is.
No, it's not.
I'll show you a little bit of simulations.
Can I just ask a question for clarification? So, is the according to the simulation, or is the number of mutations that contribute to this, what you were just referring to, is that sort of smoothly increasing or changing with this beta, or is it something, or is there, this is, would be in some sense one of the error sources of this thing, that is here in the simple theory just set to 1.
Yeah, through the
general error is sort of more or less.
I'll show some numerics for different values of beta in a moment. So let's do some comparison with numerics. So this is to begin with. So if there's nothing else written up here, this will always be for the exponential distribution. So here you see the rate of adaptation as a function of population size. Now, for small populations, this is up to 10 to the 5 or so, you see that this is a log-log plot with slope 1. So this tells you that the rate of adaptation is linear in the population size. So this is sort of the periodic selection regime. And this is for large population. You see that it goes roughly as log n. And so here, so this is the simulation, and this is this Gerish-Lenski evaluated, the integral evaluated with the full expression for the fixation probability and so on. And so you see the agreement is reasonable. So the error is not bigger than 15 or 20% at this point.
But it's getting worse for large n.
It's getting, yes, I mean, it's going to be completely off for very large n, but not, you know, large. The question is what, you know, how far do you want to go? I mean, up to 10 to the 9, I think it's quite, and this is sort of a reasonable size for experiments. Now this is now from a recent preprint by Desai and collaborators, where they actually varied this parameter beta. So they considered three cases: 0.5, 1. So 1 is the exponential, and 10 is something that is very sharply dropping off. And their conclusion is, I think, essentially the same as ours, in the sense that if you look at the beta equal to 1 case, so these dotted lines are Gerish-Lenski. Okay, so you see in particular for beta equal to 1, the agreement with Gerish-Lenski is very good. But of course, as you go down, so in particular here, you can see that in this regime, so this beta equal to 10, here Gerish-Lenski is obviously underestimating the data. And so this is obviously, here you're really in a regime where these multiple mutations become very important. Okay, For beta equal to 1, this seems to work rather well, which is sort of my interpretation. My interpretation of this is that the multiple mutations are not that important, and I'll get to sort of a different way of quantifying the effect of multiple mutations in a moment. I think what is true here is, of course, that multiple mutations do affect other properties. They don't necessarily affect the rate of adaptation, but they do show up in other properties more strongly. That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, there's some sort of a break in the behavior here. But, yeah, I can't tell you.
So the dashed line is the Gerish.
Yes. And this is, this is sort of a kind of multiple mutation analysis. Okay, so this is sort of based on your paper, I believe.
I mean, both effects come in.
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of this idea that you determine a predominant mutation size as a function of beta, but we can discuss it later. Okay, so let's look at some. So this is again some experimental data. These are a little bit older, and this is again basically just qualitative. I mean, this is rate of adaptation as a function of what they call here the mutation supply rate. So this is essentially the product of population size and mutation rate. So here they were using some mutator strains of E. coli, which allows them to vary the mutation size by a big number. And so, you know, what you're just supposed to see here is that this dependence is not linear. I mean, it's there is, as you increase n, the increase in the adaptation rate is slowing down. And there are two cases. There is one, this is a population that is not adapted to the medium, and this is a population that was already adapted, and there, of course, you don't really see any change at all. So there is no, there, which means that here, of course, there are no beneficial mutations available anymore.
Nick, these are also E. coli in...
This E. coli, yeah. This is Lenski's group.
So this is the very long-term...
Well, okay, I don't actually know what the number of generations change in fitness per 1,000 generations, but I think it's probably just 1,000 generations, so it's not... But these are these are strains taken from Lenski's experiment. That I think, is a correct
statement. The total claim is 40,000.
Right. Yeah.
They actually, I mean, interestingly, they... And I'm not sure if this is published, but they... The rate of increase of the fitness is going down, but the rate of fixation... of beneficial mutations, I mean, to much as they can measure it, which they way of estimating it, is staying roughly constant or even going up.
Mm.
So the effects of them is going down.
Right,
the
right.
The rate of
right.
fixing is actually
right.
going up.
Yeah. Okay, so this is now, again, this is this increase of the selection coefficient of fixed mutations. For small populations, this is 0.04 to SB. And here, again, this is a comparison of simulations and Gerish-Lensky. This is the large N asymptotics, which in this case actually is already quite reasonable. And again, this is something that you can see in qualitative terms also in experiments. So this is the average size of selection coefficients as a function of the population size. And you can see here an increase, which is roughly logarithmic. This is these circles, which you probably can't see, are using mutator strains. So they have a bigger mutation rate. So it's still log n, but with a larger intercept. What they also looked at is the coefficient of variation. So this is a measure of the width of the distribution. So I told you that the distribution also becomes more narrow as a function of the population size. And again, this is something that we can sort of see in the simulations as well. Okay, but here you can see here also that there is a rather large discrepancy between Gerish-Lensky and the simulation. So the distributions in the simulations are considerably broader than in the theory. So I think this is certainly one case where the neglect of multiple mutations is important. Now the question is, can you actually try to determine the parameters of the model from comparison with experiments? And here I just wanted to point out, you know, some difficulties associated with that. So this is again from this Perfetto-Gordo article. And what they tried to do here, so I told you they were working with two different population sizes. And this is a parameter space of beneficial mutation rate and the expected selection coefficient. And what they did was essentially to simulate a similar model for a variety of parameters and compare with the outcome of the experiments, the statistics that they find in the experiments. And so so one set of points is for the large population. The other set of points is for the large population. So the point is that because things, of course, always depend on S and U in certain combinations, you cannot really extract both of them, but you can extract a combination of these two parameters. And so their argument was that since we have two population sizes, that you have to pick the parameters from a regime which sort of fits both population sizes. So out here, you can sort of, with one set of parameters, you can fit one population size. With another set of parameters, you can fit another population size. But you should really go into this regime here where the two data sets come together. And so that's sort of what they use to determine the rate. And so that, for example, leads you to a beneficial mutation rate, which is 10 to the minus 4, which is much, much bigger than what was expected previously. So that was sort of the main punchline of that paper, was that according to this analysis, there are many more mutations than you would have expected. However, a similar plot, this is again from the experiment of the Harvard group, and so they also varied the shape of the distribution. Okay, so they used the exponential distribution, but they also used other distributions. And so this picture shows you that depending on which distribution you choose, you also end up in different areas of parameter space. So in some sense, this is obviously not, at least the kind of information that is presently available is not really sufficient to fix these things. But it also tells you that it's somehow important to think about the dependence on this PB. Okay, so let me, to sort of conclude this part about clonal interference, I want to go back to this issue of multiple mutations. And discuss it in a little bit more detail. So there's one aspect of this process which this Gerish-Lensky approximation gets completely wrong, which is the process, So in this small population regime, as I said, you have these fixation events are independent. So what happens is that the mutation appears, and it spreads. And after the mutation has spread, the whole population is again monomorphic. So there's one genotype that just spreads in the population, and so in that sense you're sort of reset to the initial state. So the initial state is that everybody has the same genotype. After the mutation, you have the same genotype again. Now as you increase, and this is of course not changed by just deleting some of the mutations. So the process, the assumption is still that you have these fixation events where one mutation takes over the whole population. However, what happens in reality, of course, in this clonal interference regime, that you will at any given time have several clones being there at the same time. So the notion of fixation becomes different. And so you have to distinguish two different kinds of processes here. This is a distinction that goes back to Gillespie. And so the picture is the following. So you have here these mutations. So this is what Gillespie calls the origination process. So here on this line, you see all the mutations that eventually will go to fixation. So you don't see those that are lost. You only see those that go to fixation. So every one of these lines eventually ends up at frequency 1. But what you can also see is that these mutations, if there are many of them, they will tend to coalesce. So you will tend to get clones which share two of these mutations or several of these mutations. And then they all go to fixation together. So you have one point process down here, which is the origination process. And you have another point process up here, which is the fixation process. And you see that at each of these fixation events, typically more than one mutation can go to fixation at the same time. Okay, so obviously one important measure for the importance of multiple mutations in this context is how many mutations go to fixation at once in one of these processes. Okay?
Is this recombination now?
No, recombination.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so I think I'm going to see. So this is how it works. So so the question is, what does fixation actually mean in this context? So in the beginning, I told you fixation means that you have one genotype or one mutation that just spreads and acquires frequency 1. This doesn't happen here anymore. So what fixation means here is that there's a change of the most recent common ancestor, which means that there are some set of mutations which everybody in the population shares. Okay, and if this set changes, this is what we call fixation. And so the picture is the following. So this is this infinite sites model. So these are some individuals which have some mutations. And so, for example, at this point, you see that everybody shares the red mutation. So the red mutation at this point is fixed in the population. Okay, so now a little bit later, for example, in one generation later, these leave offspring. These two don't leave offspring. So after this event, you see that there are now a set of three mutations which are fixed. And so this is a multiple fixation event. So here you see that the blue and the green one are fixed together. Okay, so this is how you should think about it. But of course, even at this point, the population is not homogeneous because there are some that have the purple mutation and others don't. Okay, so this is sort of. So the question is, what is the distribution of the number of mutations that go to fixation simultaneously in this sense? Okay? Is that clear?
This is clear, but yeah. Previous is terrible.
Okay. And so this just illustrates these different processes once more. So this is as a function of time. You can just count different things. You can, for example, count the number of mutations in the most populated genotype. You can count the number of fixed mutations. So these are the number of mutations that are present in all genotypes. And you see that this line is below that, but it has sort of the same slope. So these two things appear, they sort of grow at the same rate, which just means that the distribution of the number of mutations has a bounded width. And this is the number of fixation events, and you see that this has a smaller slope. So the number of fixation events grows more slowly than the number of mutations.
I'm confused how you define the number of fixation events.
Well, these are the events, right? I just look at those events, there's a change in the most recent common ancestor of the population. This is a fixation event. Where the set of mutations that is shared by the whole population changes.
When the frequency line reaches 1.
Yes. Okay. So what is the distribution of these? Okay, so this is just showing the rate of these processes. And you see, so this is again Gerasht-Lensky. So Gerasht-Lensky theory doesn't really predict anything about this, because in the Gerasht-Lensky theory there's sort of no distinction between these two processes. But you can see that the rate of substitutions as predicted by Gerasht-Lensky agrees rather well with the origination process, but the fixation process has a smaller rate, okay? And this is the asymptotic limit SB. Now, what is the distribution of the number of simultaneously fixed mutations? So this turns out, just from the numerics, turns out to be a geometric distribution. So if you just ask, what is the probability that you have k mutations being fixed at the same time, it's a geometric distribution, and there is a parameter in this geometric distribution, q, and this parameter is in some sense a measure for the importance of multiple mutations, because the mean is 1 over q, so that tells you that on average 1 over q mutations are being fixed simultaneously. And here you see q as a function of the population size, and you see that here, down here, this is sort of still the periodic selection regime. Here, q is 1, so there's only one mutation fixed at the same time, and then it sort of goes down here with n, and it reaches about 2/3 for 10 to the 9, which means that on average 1.5 mutations are being fixed at the same time. Now, this plot also contains two other lines. There's this green line here, which is a result that is known from the literature for the neutral Moran process, where it is known that there is a geometric distribution and it has a parameter which depends on Q in this way. And the second set of data are for the model with a constant selection coefficient, so where the distribution is S minus S0. And you see that Q in that case, so the same, you have the same basic phenomenon. You also have an exponential distribution, but you see that in that case, Q is smaller, which just means that, you know, multiple mutations are more important. And that sort of comes back to this argument that I was giving before, that depending on how quickly the distribution decays, you expect that multiple mutations will play a bigger or smaller role. So I expect, I mean, we haven't done that, but I expect if you were to calculate this Q for different values of beta, that you would see that for small beta it's up here, and for large beta it's down here. So that's sort of a number, I think, which one could sort of use.
1 over Q is the number, the mean number?
The mean number of mutations that are fixed simultaneously. So here,
what is your mutation rate here?
10 to the minus 6.
So let's see, so if I put a number, so that's about 10 to the minus.
So here, 10 to the 8, it's 2.5. 1 over q is 2.5.
And if you just do the simple, the ratio of the logs of ns and log s over m, what does this give?
In terms of what the
So for the delta function case as a result, right, which is that the number that fits together is twice the log ns.
Okay, I haven't actually compared that. Yeah, that actually would be, yeah, one should just compare it with
this. This comes down logarithmically, and it's also logarithmically
right,
dependent
mutation rate. I mean, this, I'm pretty sure that this is something like, you know, 1 over, that this goes as again, with a log. I mean, we haven't.
It doesn't involve this combination n times u.
Okay. I'll check that.
Log
ns
divided by log s over u, twice that. I mean, right, it's depending exactly your definition of the.
Yeah. Okay. So this is sort of one way of looking at these multiple mutations. And finally, and this is actually the point that got me involved or got me interested in this problem in the first place. This is a paper by Gerasht from 2001, where he looks at the statistics of these point processes, right? So essentially, you have these point processes, and you can of course ask, what is their, you can analyze their statistics, so you know if, and you know, for example, you can ask what is the variance of the number of events up to a certain time divided by the mean, which is something called the index of dispersion.
So, I'm just confused a bit by this picture. So the origins are on the wild type, or the origins are on the ones that are already, I guess I'm confused by this.
No, the origins are just, there are mutations that appear and that eventually will go to fixation in this generalized sense. So you just look at all the mutations that appear, and then you keep track of those that eventually will go to fixation. And then you say those originated at such a time with retrospect.
Okay.
I mean,
but then your definition of the the number that go together, you say, is associated with looking at when the sort of when the coalescent tree loses its branches in the
Yes, right. Right.
And I think that just has an exponential distribution.
Well, in the neutral case, it is. But the,
I think here, well,
the point is that here it's really also. I mean, we haven't been able to find this result in the presence of selection.
I guess what is confusing to me is that all the lines, they start all from the same place here, while on this axis lower.
Yeah.
While in fact they happen on the back.
Yes. Yeah. It's not so clear what this really means. I mean, well, except that it's sort of the frequency of each of these mutations.
But then the second one is happening on the line of the first, right?
Well, not necessarily.
I mean, I guess part of the confusion is that this picture says something else than all the other pictures that you've seen so far with these squares, but these lines start somewhere in the population.
Yes.
So this is strictly frequency.
Yes.
So every line starts at zero, regardless in which clone it's.
Right,
so
right.
That will be the different points y-axis that you had.
And of course, I think this merging, of course, is not, I don't think this is a merging in frequency. This is something else. I think this is probably confusing.
The
point is that this kind of thing, of course, also happens within subpopulations, right? So this means that here, when this happens, there is now a subpopulation which shares these two mutations.
Okay.
And then the frequency would be the same. Yes. Then the frequency has to be the same. Yes. Yes. You're right. So in that sense, the merging.
The same after a long time because there's already a lot that have the first one. Then the second one comes in and is in a small fraction population. So eventually the frequency of those is the same after they both fix together.
So these are sort of, I think these are sort of frequencies of these colored balls, right?
The width of the bubble in the other picture. So there is a no crossing constraint.
Yeah.
Since we're only talking about fixed mutations, no two line of these can cross, but they can coalesce.
Right.
And this is exactly the point in time when their frequencies become the same.
Yeah. Okay, so the question is, what is the statistics of these point processes? And so Gerrish did a calculation within this, again, the Gerrish-Lenski theory, where he claims that in the clonal interference regime, this index of dispersion takes on a value which is much smaller than 1 and which has which is sort of universal in the sense that it doesn't depend on the distribution of mutations and so on. And so this paper was called The Rhythm of Microbial Adaptation. So this tells you that this process of fixation now becomes much more regular than a Poisson process because this ratio is small compared
is
to 1.
Is this for exponential distribution?
No, this doesn't depend on the distribution. It's sort of a kind of, it's really just an order statistics argument. I mean, the argument is I couldn't explain it to you, but
I think this is something these things one can work out exactly. There's a sort of standard coalescence process, which is is related to a coalescence process with a very broad distribution of number of offspring, so that you can get, say, one individual has some chance of having half of the total offspring of the next generation. And there's a coalescence process of that, which has different properties than normal coalescence process, which will, I think, gives you all these.
But it doesn't have selection really, then, does it? Or?
No, it's got all the selection in it. It's got everything in it with multiple mutations, a clonal difference, everything.
Okay. So I would be interested in seeing. I mean, this is, you know, this is derived, but it's not derived in a way that is very, very clear, and it's also not okay. But the point is, of course, that this because the process that Gerrish considers is somehow not uniquely defined, you don't really expect this to be true. And so what we find is, so this is now the index of dispersion of these two processes, the origination process and the fixation process. And you see that it actually does decrease from 1. This is the limit predicted, or the limiting value predicted by Gerrish. And so what we see is that the fixation process here has a minimum, whereas the origination process goes further down, which means that asymptotically for large n, the origination process, the variance actually goes to 0, so it becomes completely regular, whereas the fixation process, and this is sort of an argument that I don't want to give here, this actually goes back up to 1 for extremely large n. But it's still, in some sense, it's remarkable that, you know, the effect as such really exists. And you can see that this effect is rather strong already for populations where in other quantities you wouldn't really see much effect of clonal interference yet. So in that sense, I think this is again, in some, I mean, to me, it tells you that this Gerasch-Lenski theory is really capturing something that is quite non-trivial. So in this regime, there are multiple mutations basically don't play any role, but you still have this very sizable decrease in the index of dispersion. So there is really a kind of stronger regularity in the process than random.
Somehow, so this increase of the red line again with large n. So is this would then mean? Is this due to fluctuations in the number if you have these big clusters?
It's purely due to this distribution. So Q goes to zero. So this distribution, so you have strong fluctuations in the number of mutations that come together. So essentially our picture is that this origination process essentially becomes like a clock.
Yeah.
Okay, but then you sort of cluster 1/Q of these events together.
Right.
And so in the end, you know, that gives you again a Poisson process. So you have this regular process, and on top of that, you have a process with rate q, and q goes to zero. So that gives you a Poisson process again.
And then somehow this picture of that always the strongest is picked, and this self-consistently sets the scale. This doesn't look right for that regime.
In that regime, this is completely wrong. Yeah, I mean, this is certainly the regime where you know multiple mutations are very important. But the point is that there is this, you know, there is this regime here where they are not important and where this effect is still rather strong.
But I think it does still end up the basic idea of the Gerasch as well. I mean, not where it comes from, but the basic idea of it, I think, for these reasons of that they this Q going to zero, I guess.
Right.
Does end up that the dispersion of these fixation processes has a width of order. But is more more sharply peaked than Poisson. So I think qualitatively that's probably correct. But I say you can write. I mean, there's a process by which is the correct process, which then you can just do this analysis for, and then you know, where you're doing the analysis numerically for that particular coalescent process. So there's something which you could do, which has the parameter analogous to this Q.
Mm-hmm.
Coming into it, so a lot of these things can work out.
Okay, I think this would actually be a good time to take a break because then, yeah. So then I'm going to talk about epistasis and recombination in the last part. So yeah.
So can I just ask, what's the implications of this as regards neutral coalescent theory? One possible conclusion is that the presence of these beneficial mutations is going to completely change everything about the way things coalesce, and therefore it kind of destroys coalescent theory. I mean, and we might kind of conclude that it's a waste of time doing these models of coalescence with migration and haplotypes and all this, because, I mean, they just ignore something about selection which has such a big effect. I mean, that's one possible conclusion, right? Or the other conclusion is kind of what Marty was saying on a lunchtime talk, where the effect of selection is basically to reduce the effective population size, and once we've accounted for that, we've acknowledged that the effective population is much smaller than the real population, then maybe we're okay. So, you know what I'm saying? So is there any point in looking at neutral models of coalescence, given that we know there is some real selection?
I don't think I can answer that.
Yeah, I could say something about this on Friday, but you can add neutral mutations to this, and then you really have to carefully keep track of what's coming in the populations in time and the whole distributions and so on. So in this population, which is so everything's well mixed and so sweep state time from order log n, then you can analyze it, and basically there's a parameter which I think is 1/Q. I don't understand your definition of Q, especially it's the opposite of our definition of Q.
There's a
parameter which is related to 1/Q, which ends up being like an effective population size here. So if you look at the way that the neutral mutations fix, they're all fixing by hitchhiking. Now this is asexual population, so I mean sort of extreme limit. They're all fixing by hitchhiking. The sweeps are going very fast and regularly, but there's still enough diversity in the population, both of these beneficial mutations and of the neutral mutations, that there are quite a lot of things that will look very similar to the normal neutral case. Now the coalescent process is somewhat, is effective coalescent process somewhat different, but not enormously different. If you look at some of these statistics, like the of the polymorphism and so on, they're pretty similar. Some of the more detailed distribution of what frequency you find in population are somewhat different, but not enormously so. And so there is a lot of it which will carry through even in the asexual population. But in these cases with very small effective population size. If you start putting in sort of more realistic processes for sweep times, which has some spatial structure or island model or something like that, then you'll get more diversity coming in. Again, at least roughly speaking, some of the processes will still work. And you can sort of say what the effective population sizes would be. So, at least with that. Once you get to the combination, then it's, likely it's more complicated. But and certainly the recombination coming of these models will increase the effective population size by quite a lot. But I think how much it increases by at this point, I don't understand.
But when people are doing the data fitting, they're considering the effective population size as essentially a parameter that they don't know anyway.
Right.
So the question is it valid to say that the effect of selection is to give us some reduced value of the effective population size, which we can then consider as a parameter in a neutral coalescent model, and then forget about all the complicated stuff here?
So the sort of first order effect is yes, that it is a parameter, but if you look more carefully at statistics of various things, they're different. And so particularly some of the statistics of the coalescent process.
Yeah, so one thing that Suchan has been looking at is sort of the coalescent properties of this model. So you can, of course, take this model, right, Fisher, with selection, and you can ask questions about coalescence times, right? And certainly they look very different from the neutral case. I mean, we don't really know what they are at this point, but certainly the statistics is completely different, not surprisingly. But
I mean, the diffusion process of alleles with the population is very different, because as you had here in the first slide, so the fate of a mutation, whether it's fixed or not fixed, I'm not talking about both the driving ones and the driven ones, is decided at very low frequency.
Right.
And then it's either pushed or yeah. While in the classical diffusion, it's...
In this Garish-Lenski, that's it, correct.
Yeah.
With the multiple mutation effects, you can have things that rise up to more half the population size and then crash back down again, which again looks more like conventional.
Right, but
for other reasons, maybe. No.
So you have something. You have something which is very close to a diffusion kernel for when the mutations are, between 1% and 99%, say. It's very close to a conventional diffusion kernel, but with a different different coefficient that depends upon this whole multiple mutation process. So there is actually, the regimes where it's, where some things like that sort of carry through. I think the details of the process are different, and there's other asymmetries between almost fixed and almost not fixed, or barely there at all if you know the history. But you actually do get this bouncing up and down a lot. The statistics are somewhat different, but at least the things quantities I've looked at so far, it's probably pretty difficult to tell the differences.
Yeah.
Is it obvious that the distribution of, say, mildly deleterious mutations doesn't change, for example, the origination probability and things like that?
I should say this is not, we haven't really. I mean, there are some arguments why, in the end, deleterious mutations don't matter, but I'm not sure that this extends to everything that I've said. I mean, we haven't really actually investigated that.
I think what happens if you crank up the mutation rate, the rate of fixation gradually goes up sort of logarithmically in the mutation rate, and then you get to some mutation rate where it crashes, and in a very small range of changing in the mutation rate, well, at least logarithmically of the mutation rate, which comes in, it crashes down, and then you get
Muller's ratchet kind
then
of
you get ratchet kind of
I mean that's sort of the right. So the picture is, of course, if you have deleterious mutations, they will sort of tend to push the population back, and so there has to be enough beneficial mutations to keep on driving it. But as long as this happens, sort of in the behavior in the tail is. I mean, in some sense, you know, everything that I say here would still apply to that part of the population which doesn't have any deleterious mutations or has few deleterious mutations. So there's a load that slows things down. But
the load sort of slows everyone down.
Yeah.
The first order, the load slows everyone. Everyone's got this deleterious load. You're picking up things on top of that, so it sort of slows everyone down. And then what happens is that the very small effect deleterious mutations make very little difference. The very large effect ones everyone's getting the whole time, they don't make a difference. And there's the characteristic size of the deleterious mutations, which is roughly the sort of sweep of the fixation time. So the ones you most have the biggest effect are deleterious mutations that come in sort of while things are fixing. Mm-hmm. Those are ones where if you crank up your own mutation rate, kill you at some point. But there's a lot of cancellations of the effects of the deleterious mutations. And so, of course, if you're competing two separate populations against each other, one of which has more deleterious mutations than the other, then you'll see those effects. But for this, the process itself, as I'll say, there's a lot of cancellation, except for ones in a particular range.
So. Okay, so maybe we can have coffee and come back 10 minutes? Okay.
First reaction was, in this asexual case, that things were going to be very different from the neutral theory, and there wasn't going to be enough. You've got enough recombination in there that you could move toward a regime where it might kind of work, but I think thinking of some ranges of parameters where I don't have any think about it at all. So maybe strong selection and lots of pretty high rates.
So where's the real wealth?
It depends on the organism, right?
But I think it's too relevant.
So for bacteria, it might be the real world. It might not be the real world for mouse.
So recombination makes things better in terms of the coalescent theory, doesn't it? And
well,
because it makes things more averaged out in some way.
I think the perturbations aren't quite so dramatic or something. Right? I mean, you get bumped a little bit by a selective event at some point.
They are transported into the
neutral. Yeah. But you don't get this thing.
But they are
really
neutral. They are just small.
I don't have much experience thinking about these things where there's three or four selected things going at once.
It's just an indication
of things. I think we're start looking kind of neutral again, except not at some detail.
It's quite deterministic. I mean, you have strong selection. It's just sort of pushing up.
But if you have recombination, then I think it's that you get the stochastic element pushed quite so far, so hard.
These things are driving things very sort of stumbling forward.
That's right.
Neutral theory is more or less drifting around.
So I was surprised when you said that it looks like neutral at a different population size.
Yeah. Even in this regime, the strong assumption that neutral changes.
There was a thing I simulated a long time ago, which was a Muller's ratchet model. So you're looking at fixation of slightly deleterious mutations, and I just looked at coalescence. I just looked at probability that two random individuals have a coalescent time, and that's so instead of being an exponential, it's a peak. And I don't know how to do that. Right? I mean, it's
close to the neutral.
It goes up from zero and then down.
Well,
then there's all these sites that are rates.
The way I think about that,
slower than the neutral rate.
That kind of situation is you start out and you sample from
them. They're not neutral mutations.
In some sense, when you randomly sample two, they're probably the common ancestor. The previous generation is like one over the population size, kind of thing. Even in that, even in a model that's subdivided into very different types. But that if you go back in time, they converge to the same kind of class, toward more fit classes. And so then the times that the common ancestors are traditional having gone back with certain generation become higher. So that distribution doesn't look like exponentially anymore. You have low probabilities initially and then high probabilities later. And that leads to these more unimodal sort of distributions.
That evolved a billion
years. Does that make sense?
And it was actually the same. In other words, the probability of one or two coalescing very quickly is essentially the same. So it's one of, so it's 1 over n e to the minus t over n for the neutral, right? So you've got that limit. And instead of just decaying this like this way, it was going up and then down. So then,
nothing going on.
I was kind of understanding that as saying that there's some, it takes some time for selection to have an effect, right? I mean, selection it doesn't mess things up in just two or three generations. It messes things up.
That's what I was saying. As you fall, so I think of that Muller's ratchet sort of model. Well, most of my experience thinking about it is where the classes have sort of fixed sizes and the ratchet doesn't have to operate. But I think with the ratchet operating, it's still is kind of a similar model where you have a least loaded class of one mutation or two mutation. You can think of those as sort of a subdivided population, and lineages have a tendency to move toward those most fit classes as you go back. But when you sample at the beginning, there's some probably you're sampling from the same class or from different classes. That's right. But anyway, at the beginning, there's sort of low probabilities of coalescing.
But as you get farther back, there's high
probability. I just repeated what I said a minute ago.
There's another interesting case of that, which is where you say, well, only the best ones have offspring. So there's some distribution of the classes, but if you assume that everybody is descended from one of the best ones, then basically you're back to neutral coalescence again with a smaller population size.
And the way I think about that model is that when you have mutations, that your ancestors are better, are from a better class with fairly high probability, and the time it takes you to get your ancestor back to that most fit class is pretty short if the selection is strong. But if you start to move it very slowly, then that part becomes longer and then becomes a significant part of the whole history. And you get these trees in, if you take bigger samples, that tend to have long terminal branches together, so it's a distorted tree compared to the neutral. But if the selection is strong enough, all lineages move over that least loaded class right away. But that's all the dilatory stuff. Many sites going at the same time.
It's not clear.
So is there actually a source of coffee available at this time of the morning?
Of course, in the kitchen.
But those things are usually empty in the morning.
Not now. I mean, there's at least one.
Well, okay, I've got to get my cup.
There was one that wasn't empty 5 minutes ago. I can't say anything.
I don't understand how the machine works, otherwise we could just refill it again for ourselves.
Yeah, but I think it's not. We're not supposed to, right? There was.
I thought it was the opposite. We were encouraged to learn how it works and operate it. Wow. But I don't know.
I've been for a long time. I should find these things out.
Tutorial.
Kind of thing.
Preprint on the archive about the coffee
machine.
the dispersion of the deoxidation process theory?
Well, it's on the fixation. Yeah, but what you are concerned about is the origination one is really the one you, I think you care about, because that tells you how many things have fixed over a period of time. The fixation one, you have to compound it with the number of events at each one.
Yes.
So you really want to know events times number, times number, and you add those up over a very long period.
Yes.
Once you get that very long, it's just the origination process. So it's a little easier. To me, it's easier to just think about the
origination process. And two is also...
Oh, it still looks like the origination process.
That's right. The two look the same when you add, when you take a multiplicative of an event times the number it fits.
Yeah.
That's got to equal the origination.
That's got to equal that. That's the origination.
But the little flip, with a little blip on the end is all a margin, sort of boundary.
Yeah, so it's like the fixation process, you lump all these origination events in large clusters, which correspond to the zone. And well, that's obviously more.
But if you're interested in the numbers of substitutions, it's not the number of fixation events, it's the number of origination. You have to multiply each of them by a number, and
so it equals
the origination. Well, no, I mean, it's not a plus. Well, I forget. Was the origination process, what is the index of dispersion of that? It had some big dip.
The origination process became completely regular.
Yeah, it became completely regular.
Well
the index of dispersion.
Very long limits, and sort of a nice distribution.
So index dispersion goes to zero.
And the reason for that is that the clone in which the next mutation springs up has to grow in the beginning. So there's nothing going to happen at the very beginning.
Right.
Because you have to have a sizable clone before before you get the next mutation. And then sort of it's pretty rapidly cut off because the clone grows so rapidly. So you're going to get the next mutation. So the probability of the rate of getting the next mutation is very low in the beginning. Then it starts to peak with the growing clone, but then it's going to be cut off. Well, then it's it happens after some time.
Right.
This is why it happens a pretty narrow time window.
I see. So that gets irregular in a period that's sort of determined by the time to fixation.
So after one origination, you have this latency time. After which the clone has to grow before it can produce a sizable number of mutations. And this latency makes this regular spacing
much more regular.
But that's obviously different if you have recombination, because then you don't have some latency, because it can come up in a different way. Then you can start up right away.
But if you're just talking about the coding region of one gene or something like that, depending on how fast these.
Yeah, but then the rates, the mutation rates are low.
Yeah.
The adaptive mutation rates are low, and then you're back into the
region. It's 10^-6, so it's genome wide.
Those rates are. I don't trust those experiments at all. E. coli experiments. You look at the details of those experiments, there's all kinds of bizarre patterns that just shouldn't be there, but I just don't trust them.
Well, is it a problem just, because there's a lot of heterogeneity in those hemostats themselves, so is it something, creating a much more complex heterogeneous environment?
So they do this thing where they put in a plasmid that has these repeats on it. And apparently the mutation rate is very high, and it generates this distribution of lengths quite quickly. And
this
then they kind of put
satellites.
So they get very quickly they generate this distribution of lengths, and then they put them in this regime and look for one of these length variants that shoot up in frequency and others that go down or something. But the mutation process, this microsatellite thing, just seems to be. When I look at this, it seems like it's very unstable. They'll be in a regime where they're mutating like crazy, and another regime where they're not mutating.
So they're looking for slow processes like the origination of mutations in genome proper. How come it isn't washed out by the mutation processes?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on. I think somehow these mutation rates in different conditions are very different or something. Anyway, I just found it very strange, their pattern of variation that these microsatellites. I was afraid.
But there the evidence is the big populations, we did that order 4 or 5, so mutations coming together. From trying to fit the things it's over, it's not to directly measure the limits.
I don't know.
But they didn't rely on something like that.
Sorry?
They haven't been reasonable.
No, they started to do bits of it.
Did they start them out?
I think they start them out.
But then, no, they're known.
One gene type, but then they can generate all these markers within them.
But it gets, you know, even there, because the abortion was done, we're actually very
sequential genes,
something slightly different.
You pick out every time you can.
So it's you know, all these ones are.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't. It's not like I understood.
But there's the, you know, the qualitative difference in the processes, which I think in some ways is the most interesting. Is the most interesting aspect. And in particular, you know, once you have sex.
Yeah.
I mean, in the simple Gary Slansky paper, sex makes things worse. Right? If you run asexually for a while and recombine, you actually narrow. You get worse. Because you get the new ones that come in, you're unlikely to have.
In
if there's two new ones coming in, you're unlikely to get them together, you actually separate, so you actually narrow the distribution of things.
I haven't seen that people have really addressed that explicitly. I mean, usually the assumption is just that in the presence of sex, you'll just stay in this periodic selection regime, right? Because everything sort of fixes independently.
No, but do you know anyone that has even conjectures as to how much recombination
will be? Oh, yeah, right.
I just noticed that, at least in the sort of old papers.
I know.
They sort of addresses this explicitly, what really happens in terms of how much recombination.
Just one slide on that. Yeah, it's very tricky. I mean, but it's but basically, as long as you have a fixed amount of recombination and then take n larger and larger in the model, then you always body everything, even with recombination. With a fixed recombination. You know, where you get to the log n can be it depends somewhat where you get to, depends on what the recombination. But in the end, you still get the log. You still get the log n. It just pushes it out. And I think the more you have a long tail to be in distribution businesses, the less the effect of sex anyway.
Yeah.
And the.
I'll talk a little bit about recombination at the end. So in this second part, I want to address mainly effects of epistasis. So, you know, so far everything that I've said was based on this multiplicative model, where the fitness effects of different mutations are independent. Now, epistasis, you know, to the extent that I have been able to understand this somewhat mysterious term, seems to imply that there are interactions between different mutations, right? So epistasis is what in physics we would call interactions. And so the general setting where I want to discuss this is that we now have a finite number of loci, and we have some binary variable which tells us whether there's a mutation there or not. And then the fitness is a function of this set of loci, and so it's a function on this hypercube of 2 to the L genotypes, some function W of sigma. And the absence of epistatic interactions means that, at least in the sort of discrete time setting that I'm using, means that this is a product of terms which only depend on each of the variables. So anything that sort of is different from this would imply that there's epistasis. Okay, and so I want to discuss two questions here. The first one is, what is the effect of epistasis on the processes that I've been discussing? And the second question is, what do we know about the epistasis of real fitness landscapes? And both of these will be rather, of course, a very, very limited recent results that I want to discuss here. So to get to the first question, so far I've been discussing this, the non-epistatic case in the context of this infinite sites limit. Now it turns out that there is a second version of this infinite sites model, which is in a certain sense maximally epistatic. Okay, so maximally epistatic, it's sort of in a sense that I can specify if you want, but
But let me just describe what the model is. So this is actually a model that was invented by Kingman, and it's called the House of Cards model. So the only difference to what I was discussing before is that instead of drawing the fitnesses, instead of drawing selection coefficients at random and multiplying the selection coefficients with the fitness of the parent, you draw the fitness itself at random. Okay, so every new mutant has a new fitness, which of course can be deleterious or beneficial depending on if W is bigger or smaller than what you had before. So you create a new genotype and you create a new fitness at random. And so this is essentially, you know, so the main message that I want to convey here is that this is a model that you can treat rather completely, both in the finite and infinite population setting. In the infinite population setting, this is it sort of reduces to this rather simple looking iteration scheme for the frequency distribution of the fitness. So U is now the total mutation rate per individual. And so, so there are basically two cases. Either there's no mutation, then there's a selection term. The frequency goes to W times the frequency, and there's a mutation term. So if you get hit by a mutation, your fitness is just reset to a random value drawn from G. Okay. So this iteration was what Kingman studied for distribution with bounded support. So if you have a maximal fitness, basically the frequency distribution is sort of pushed towards the upper limit, and you can calculate the mutation distribution I guess
I'm confused by the dynamics and the kind of, this is infinite n. Right?
This is infinite n, yeah. So for bounded support, you get some mutation selection balance. For unbounded support, for example, if you take something like this, you can show that the mean fitness in the infinite population limit more or less t to the 1 over beta. So this is all, rather straightforward.
That's what the physics we know is aging, or...
Sorry?
That's some kind of aging behavior, or...
Well, of course, qualitatively, of course, what always happens in this model is that as the population is adapting, it runs out of good mutations, right? Because as the fitness level increases,
genotypes and neighboring genotypes are high impact.
Right. So this t to the 1 over beta, for beta equal to 1 for the exponential cases is linear, but we will see in the finite populations it's much slower. So it's typically, it's not the fitness obviously not growing at a constant rate anymore. I mean, here it can still grow at a constant rate, but only if you have an infinite population.
But if you take the model which you have been looking at, where you assume the distribution of S's is independent of time, right, then the infinite population result is that the fitness grows exponentially.
Yes, right.
So this is the fact that it's growing as a power law is because you're sort of running out of places
exactly,
to go,
exactly, yes.
And those compensate each other to give a power law.
Exactly, yeah. But in the finite population case can also be analyzed, and in the finite population case, it's very useful to think about this in terms of the statistics of records. So obviously, if the probability or the rate of beneficial mutations is just the total mutation rate times the probability that you find something by drawing at random that is bigger than what you already have. So obviously this will go to zero for large t. So as the fitness increases, it becomes harder and harder to find beneficial mutations. And so we found that this process can be described by what we call a diluted record process. So a record process just means that you draw random variables and you only keep those that are bigger from the one that you already have. So you have some, you draw a random variable and you keep it as long as you find something that is bigger. This is record statistics. And the only difference to standard record statistics here is that instead of always replacing the old record by the new one, you only replace it with a probability which is given again by the fixation probability. So some of the good records are lost by stochastic drift, essentially. So this is a process that you can analyze.
But it's assuming there's a monoclonal population at any time. Is it the whole population moves and then moves?
Right. The point is that when u is small, this is when u is small, this is true. Okay. So when u is small, or n times u is small, this is true. So in that limit, you can reduce it to a. So if the population is characterized as by one fitness value, and it follows this process, and one can make a simple argument that tells you that even that despite this dilution, the leading behavior is still the same on the standard as a standard record process where you keep every new mutation, and you can systematically improve that. And then it turns out if you now want to put in, you know, you go away from this approximation, the only thing that you have to do is to multiply the fitness by the mutational log 1 minus u. So this is basically, we can treat this completely analytically. And so, for example, for an exponential fitness distribution in a finite population, the asymptotic increase of this fitness is just logarithmic in t. So if infinite population, it's t. Finite population, it's log t.
So, but again, you're getting away from the nu small, but you're still assuming it's monoclonal.
No. Well, no, I'll show you what the distribution looks like in a moment. I mean, the fact that you just have to multiply it by 1 minus u is, in some sense, was asymptotically, was surprising to us as well, but it has a simple interpretation. I'll show you to you. Right, so this is just, these are some simulations. So here you see the fitness as a function of time, so the infinite population grows linearly, and then the finite population data sort of break off from this and increase logarithmically, asymptotically for long times. And this is now the comparison to this diluted record process. So here in particular you see that this, so this is by Fisher, and this is this diluted record process, and you see that they agree very well. This is the fitness variance, which goes to a constant. So you have a distribution that has a width, but the width is finite. These are some approximations. I think this is not, I don't think I want to spend too much time. You know, the basic message is that we have good control of this model. And here you see how you can sort of rescale everything. So this is now for different u and different n, and the asymptotics is always the same. So this is just log n ut. And so why do you just get this simple 1 minus u? Well, that's because the fitness distribution actually in this model is bimodal. So you typically, what you find in the infinite population limit, you can show analytically that you have a kind of decomposition. That is, the fitness distribution, you have one part of the fitness distribution which contains those individuals which have recently been hit by a mutation, which means that they're sort of, the fitness is reset to this input distribution G. Okay, so you basically so in our case G of W is an exponential, so you have this piece here. Okay, so this is FT of W. And then you have this adaptive part. And this adaptive part is moving. Okay, so these guys are adapting, but once in a while, with probability u, the guys in here are being hit and being sort of replaced here. So the dynamics is that this thing is moving. Of course, since these are the fit ones, they are producing more offspring than is needed to maintain this part. And so some fraction of that offspring is goes back here and sort of refills this part. Okay, so that's sort of the stochastic dynamics, or deterministic dynamics, which leads to this kind of behavior. But essentially, the adaptation is here, and so this traveling wave distribution, this adaptive part, is what you see here. And so this depends, depending on the distribution. So actually, in the Gaussian case, we can show that this distribution actually doesn't depend on time. It just has a fixed width, whereas in the exponential case, it sort of broadens with time.
So you said before, but how is it moving with time, the W bar for these cases?
So again, so this part, so in the exponential case, so this grows for the infinite population, it grows as t, and in the finite population as log t. But it's always bimodal. I mean, this bimodal.
You think the shape stays the same in the Gaussian case,
right,
but with a log t growth? The mean is growing as log t, but the shape stays.
Must confess that I'm not sure if this is. I think this is actually infinite population. So then the Gaussian case would go as t to the 1/2, the traveling wave. But the main point is that you always in the finite as well as the infinite population, you have the structure that you have these two peaks. This of course means that if you just look at the variance of the fitness itself, it grows very quick, very strongly, because the variance is sort of dominant. I mean, the variance grows as the mean, but this doesn't mean that the distribution is really broad, it's just bimodal. So this is just, you know, just to tell you that this is an infinite size model which you can handle. Unfortunately, of course, this is of course also not realistic. I mean, I said before the multiplicative model is probably not realistic, but this is certainly also not very realistic because it assumes that there is a complete disruption of the genotype by every mutation, so that the fitness is random. Unfortunately, as far as I know, there is nothing in between. So there is no tractable infinite size model which has a kind of intermediate level of epistasis. Here, in order to treat sort of intermediate cases, we have to go back to the finite set of loci. Yeah.
Couldn't one just make sort of the fitness decorrelate with the number of mutations?
I think you could probably cook up some mixture of the two. I mean, I haven't really thought about that, if this is useful. But I think in some sense, of course, what you really, I mean, in order to do something reasonable in between, you should somehow start from a real landscape on a space of genotypes, right? So this is sort of comes, I mean, so the question is what does this underlying landscape really look like? And that's what I want to discuss now. And then the question is, can you, in that setting, can you still make some sort of infinite size limit or not? Okay, so let me get to this. So this was, you know, this was just discussing what is the effect on at least on asexual adaptation within this house of cards model, which is something that we know. So now let's go to the empirical landscapes. And so this is recent work with Ariane de Visser. And so the data that we have been looking at are fitness data for an asexual fungus, Aspergillus niger, which looks like this. And so this is actually data that was obtained by Ariane already quite a long time ago. So in this study they were looking for epistasis, and so they measured that they were creating a large number of strains which had different combinations of mutations. So there were seven mutations that were created, and they created 186 different strains. And these strains contain two subsets of 32 each, which contain all combinations of five binary mutations. So that means that we have, in some sense, a fitness landscape for five loci, where the fitness of each of these combinations is known. Okay, so this defines a landscape on this space of 32 genotypes, and so you know, epistasis in this setting. Well, in the original study, the question that they tried to answer was how the fitness depends on the total number of mutations. So the total number of mutations here is five. So you have the wild type with zero mutations, you have five mutants with one mutation, and so on. And so in this study, the interest was in the decline of the mean fitness with a number of mutations. And in that context, epistasis means that there are deviations from an exponential function.
And where the mutations come from in the first place?
These are mutations that were known. They are basically. I mean, they were chosen in order to be detectable, right? I mean, you basically create them, and then you, of course, you have to know which strain contains what mutations. And so most of them are sort of amino acid deficiency mutations. That is, they destroy the fungus ability to synthesize a certain amino acid, so you can grow it in a medium that doesn't have that amino acid, and you know that it's there. Okay, so that's sort of the idea.
So you have ways that you can see whether it dies under certain
conditions. But then, of course, in order to determine the fitness, you grow them in a medium that contains everything, because otherwise, you know, some of them would just be dead. So that's sort of what. And I think there was one also that changes, that affects colors, which is also a nice, you know, easy way to distinguish.
Can they compensate each other?
Well, that's what we're going to see. So the question is, you know, so in the first study, the question was just what is sort of the mean decay of the fitness. But now we were sort of looking at this again in order to see more, to sort of characterize this landscape more completely, and to look for what is called sign epistasis. So sign epistasis means that the sign of a certain mutation can depend on the presence of other mutations. And so Arjan sort of insisted that we should plot the fitness as a surface, so this is what I did. So this is sort of what it looks like if you try to plot it in two dimensions. And you see it's sort of choppy and it has some maxima, but of course this doesn't really contain, this is not a very good way of representing it because you can't really see the sort of neighborhood relationships. So the representation that I prefer is this one. So here you see these 32 genotypes, and these arrows indicate increasing fitness. So this is the wild type, and this is the quintuple mutant. So these are the single mutants, double mutants, triple mutants, and so on. And so we have sort of numbers associated with all of them. Of course, these numbers come with a certain amount of error. So one question is, of course, how well do we actually know this landscape? So this is an issue that I can get into if you're interested.
How big, if you just take the single mutations, how big is the fitness loss from those?
Well, the numbers, so fitness here is essentially growth rate, and the difference between this one, so this, if this is 1, then this is something like 0.64 or so. So it's sort of on the order of 10% to
be. I see. So the single ones are a few percent.
These guys
single ones are
typically maybe 0.1. Well, there are some rather small ones, 0.7, 0.8, that sort of thing. So it's tens of percent typically. They're rather large in that sense. And so here you see there are some local maxima. Okay, so these underlying genotypes are ones which have only arrows pointing into them. So these are local maxima. You see this coloring. So the way the coloring works is that you can, to each genotype, you can define where it would end up if it did what we call a greedy uphill walk. So you only starting from a given point, you just go to the neighboring site with the highest fitness. So then you see here you have this red network and you have the blue network. And this guy only has itself as a base of attraction, and most of the other ones go to the wild type. But there you see that there is a certain amount of ruggedness. This is certainly not a random landscape. If you were to pick the fitnesses at random, you would get more local maxima than we see here. So it has a certain smoothness, but it also has a certain roughness. And one thing that is of interest in this context, and sort of a notion that was introduced by Weinreich and collaborators, is the idea of selectively accessible trajectories. So you can ask, if you now were to start here and you wanted to evolve back to the wild type, would it be possible to do so by going only uphill? Okay, so there are 120 different trajectories here, and it turns out that most of them are not accessible in that sense. That is, along most of these trajectories, you actually do have to go downhill at least once.
So which are the ones that you can get there? How are they marked?
They're not marked in this picture,
okay.
So you have to look for them.
You think a small fraction?
It's about out of those 120, I think there are maybe 30 that are accessible. It's sort of the same fraction as in Weinreich's experiment. So this is sort of the landscape. So there's of course one set of questions associated with characterizing this landscape by looking at different measures of epistasis. But the issue that we wanted to address in this context is the effect of recombination. So if you do an asexual adaptation on this landscape, it's really clear what will happen, at least as long as the population size times mutation rate is not too big. You will basically, wherever you are, you sort of go to one of these nearest maxima, and then you'll stay there for quite a while, and then you'll have some possibility of stochastically escaping to another one. So there's a kind of punctuated pattern where you go from one maximum to the other. And the question was, how is this punctuated pattern altered if you allow for recombination? And my expectation was that this is, rather trivial. Study that obviously recommendation would sort of aid you to go away from these maxima, it would sort of help you to overcome this trapping. And so what we did was to simulate.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
You're assuming that the mutation rates are low enough or the population large enough that these processes from getting one maximum via a valley to another one are much slower than everything else, or what?
We're looking at a range of mutation rates and population sizes. It turns out it doesn't. There are sort of different regimes, but the main conclusion as to the effect of recombination is actually rather robust. This is sort of something that, you know, that work that we did with Kavita some time ago. And you can sort of classify the regimes of evolution in such a landscape as a function of n times u. So when n times u is small, you have this adaptive walker, which essentially goes uphill. If you make it bigger, the population sort of starts to spread out and can cover more and more mutations. But in any of these regimes, you always have a kind of punctuation. I mean, you're always dominated by these local optima. So that's pretty robust. So what we do is we do population dynamics on this landscape, and so we have to do some sort of recombination. So what I call recombination here means, I'm not even sure if this is really the right term, but what we really want to do is to have a probability R. So this is a probability that recombination occurs. This is our parameter, and if it does so, it occurs. It means that the offspring just chooses the letter at each site at random from one of the two parents. And this is, I mean, I think in this case you shouldn't really think about crossing over, a single crossover of these sequences, because the mutations are all sitting in different chromosomes. So they don't, you don't actually have to. If you think about the biology of this organism. You basically just have to mix the chromosomes, and so this is what can happen then. And so the parameter is R, so R equal to 0 is the asexual case. And so now, you know, after we did this, we discovered that there is actually quite a big literature on this subject, and one of the most clear papers is from Eschel and Feldman in 1970. So they studied a two-locus model in the infinite population limit. And what they find is that whether or not recombination slows down or speeds up adaptation depends on the sign of the epistatic interaction, which means that in the two-locus setting, this is rather simple. So, you know, there are tons of papers in about the two-locus case. So two locus means that you have something like this. And suppose this is say the lower fitness genotype, and you want to adapt to this one. And so then you can sort of draw the. And typically, you can assume that these intermediate genotypes have the same fitness, so it's a kind of one-dimensional landscape. And then, so if this is, you know, this is AB, this is the intermediate, and this is this one. So then positive epistasis means that it looks something like this. Okay, so the double mutant is fitter than you would expect on the basis of these single mutants. Okay, so this is sort of positive. Negative is this. But what we're really interested in is sign epistasis. So sign epistasis means that there's actually a valley in between, which means that you sort of have this kind of structure. Okay, so you have to. So the single mutants are less fit than either of the two. From these two locus models, one knows that, at least in the infinite population limit, there is this, it depends on the sign in this sense, but most importantly, and this I actually found rather surprising when we saw this in our simulations, that in the lower case, if you have a fitness valley, you can actually completely suppress the shift from one peak to the other by recombination. So what recombination does, so recombination in this situation is generally very, very bad. Because what it does is that, so initially most of the population is here. You have a little bit of population here, but not much because the fitness is so low. So, and eventually by double mutation, you can create individuals up here. But as soon as they appear, they will recombine to go back into the valley, right? So they're basically, because the recombination of these guys, of course, produces these. So as soon as you have something here, it can recombine, and most of the individuals are still here, so it recombines with AB, and it sort of pushes you back into the valley. So recombination sort of actually increases the barrier rather than decreasing it. Well, there is a kind of transition. I mean, so I should say this Eshel-Feldman model is, as I said, it's infinite population and it's also unidirectional mutation. And in that case, they can prove that this happens. Essentially, there's a threshold. So R has to be, I think, on the order of the selection coefficient between these two.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the scale. The scale is the selection coefficient between this guy.
Yeah, so in some sense, the fitness of the higher one is S minus R.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, right. Okay, so this actually tells you that if you have these kind of fitness values, recombination is typically going to be bad. And
so this is infinite N.
This is infinite N, but there are also tons of studies for finite N, and I think the conclusion that crossing such valleys is made more difficult by recombination is very generic. I think this comes out in all of these studies. So let me first show that in the absence of epistasis, you actually do have an advantage of recombination. This is sort of coming back to the Fischer-Müller effect that I started with. So here we've now put a multiplicative landscape onto this five locus system, right? So we just have five loci, and we just put a multiplicative landscape that goes uphill. And then you see here, so this is now the fitness as a function of time. This is the asexual case. And now here you see, as you turn on recombination, it actually speeds things up. So that's sort of what you would expect, okay? So it's just a kind of sanity check that in the absence of recombination, this actually works. But if you now go to this empirical landscape, things are different. So I'm only showing this graph, which is actually for the infinite population. But the finite population data don't look substantially different. Well, they do look different in the sense that if the population is very small, the population is so small that it's monomorphic, nothing happens, right? So in order to have any effect of recombination, of course, you need to have at least, a certain spread of the population. But what you see here is the fitness, and so the asexual case, this is the initial, the quintuple mutant. So you first go to this, to one of these maxima, and then you go from that maximum to another maximum, and then you go to the global maximum here. And now as you turn on the recombination rate, you see that it slows down things a little, right? If you go to this 10 to the minus 2. Now here, unfortunately, again, the most interesting line is hard to see. So there's an intermediate range of recombination rates where you tend to get stuck at the first local maximum, but then you can escape from it and you go directly to the global maximum. So in this particular case, actually, the fitness reaches its maximal value faster in the presence of recombination. But this requires a certain amount of fine-tuning, and if you make the recombination rate bigger, you see this phenomenon that I just described, where you basically get stuck on this local maximum, you never escape from it. And this is some mutation rate 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 5 is not that different. And this is the second landscape. So the second landscape has a less interesting structure of local optima. So here again, you see that recombination slows things down, and eventually, if the recombination rate is sufficiently large, it sort of localizes you completely at the peak. So the general conclusion from this, which to us was first surprising, but then, looking at the literature, maybe is not that surprising after all, is that in a landscape which has a lot of epistasis, like the one that we used here, that recombination actually slows down replication. But of course, this is not I'm not pretending that this is a very general claim.
So when you said escape time is suppressed, it means escape time is literally infinite.
Well, for a finite population, I think.
So an infinite for infinite populations?
For the infinite, well, there is a subtle issue here. I mean, as I said, Eschel and Feldman prove that in this situation, when R is sufficiently large, you never escape. But this is, again, this is the unidirectional approximation. So Suchon has looked at this, including also back mutations. And it seems that if you have back mutations, this actually will not happen. So you see, in some sense, the question is whether there is a unique stationary or a unique final distribution in this system, right? I mean, you start with your population sitting here, and then you let t go to infinity. Now, in the models without recombination, we know that the operator in the infinite population case is linear, so we know there is a unique final state. In the presence of recombination, that's not obvious. It could be, in principle, you could have one solution that stays here and another solution that goes here. Because it's clear, if you start with sufficiently many individuals here, you will end up at this peak, right? So the question is whether you get multiple solutions of the infinite population equations. And it seems, according to what Suchan is telling me, is that if you include back mutations, you will not have such bimodality. So in that case, this escape rate would still be finite. But it's not something that we have sort of investigated completely.
It may go to zero exponentially in some parameters.
In the infinite, there's a paper by Reinwald and Chow where they look at this in the finite population case, and there you can sort of see that the escape time depends exponentially on R over S or something like that. So as you make R bigger, the escape, of course, then in the finite population there will always be some chance of escaping, but the escape time goes exponentially in R.
So in this figure, R equal to 1, it actually will escape at large. This for finite.
Well, here it doesn't. Well,
I mean, if I go to large enough time, I should see.
Here it doesn't seem to escape, but that might be because it's not much too low size. So I think this is a 5-local system. We have no way of sort of analyzing that analytically. So I don't know. I mean, to me, it is not. Here I think it doesn't seem to escape ever. I think it's just. So I think there must be conditions under which, even in the presence of back mutations, it doesn't escape. But
my guess is that the two locus case probably is generic in the sense of other two distributions, there are two limiting distributions or not. I mean, it's possible that there's extra things that come in,
yeah.
But I would have guessed that the sort of basic issue principle,
yeah, that's what
which is the nature
think.
Of these
yeah.
operators, yeah. is yeah. there. And that. I don't know. I mean, I
don't know. It's not clear.
There's a particular case where your bottom model there applies very well, which is in compensatory mutations in RNA helices, where you know you have pairs of sites which are interacting with one another. And so there are a lot of papers on rates of fixation of pairs of mutations in conserved RNA secondary structures.
Mm-hmm.
And there it's definitely known. I mean, exactly the reason that you say, it's known that recombination slows down the rate of fixation of pairs.
Mm-hmm. But there you would have back mutations or not?
Yeah, so there are some papers with back mutations as well.
Okay, I would be interested in seeing that, yeah. Mm.
Question. You talked about like Lenski's experiments, and you call it. And those, they're looking at some form of natural selection in a hemostat, right? And they impose some mm-hmm. conditions and they're letting them evolve. Can you get the same kind of
Lenski's one?
Well,
would you mean
maybe not his
yeah,
long-term
okay.
one.
Most of these are batched where you grow and then
yeah.
dilute and things.
Yeah, but they're evolving to something,
yeah.
whatever those
yeah.
conditions are.
Yeah.
Instead, if you impose an artificial selection scheme where you were. So you experimentally are imposing, selecting the phenotypes from the distribution of phenotypes, like what you typically do in your software, artificial selection experiments. Not as easy to do in the column. Are they quantitatively the same in terms of what you can get out? So. I guess I'm just wondering because just as in like these studies with simple viruses and with bacteria, you potentially resequence genomes and actually look at the
So what kind of selection do you want to put on? You're saying some.
Oh, sorry, just a second. So you, in Dissembly, you select for Frisselmeyer, something like that, and you select the top 20%, 40% each generation.
But E. coli people have done, you select for being able to live on some other carbon source. I mean, Lenski's book again.
Antibiotics, or antibiotic resistance.
Right.
I think they may have done searching for. I think they may have done selecting for size also. I've forgotten.
They've done temperature regimes.
Temperature regimes.
And they follow size sometimes, and they find that there are size trends.
Typically, they don't take out. Except of course, in the antibiotic case, I guess it's because you know there will be most of them will be lethal. So.
But some of the people have done a limited number of experiments in some where you actually. You sort of do 100% selection, like you're saying there. You run them through a fax machine or something else, and you pull out all the ones that have some.
It's sort of extremely strong selection in this context, maybe, right? Is that?
Yeah, maybe with these strong selection. The reason I'm asking is because, of course, like in fly, there's been a long history of people doing artificial selection things. Not so much now, but there's. Anyway, if you were to redo those experiments, and actually track, start with artificial populations whose genomes are completely sequenced, and you can actually track every single mutation as they go.
Phages did them quite a lot.
What kind of information can you actually get out of that? Maybe the dynamics would be quite complicated. I mean, you'd like to look to find evidence whether there's epistatic interactions.
So the phage is where they've done the most. There is evidence for prepostasis, and for several mutations coming at the same time. The surprising thing there, and this is actually also true in the few bacterial cases that have been sequenced, is that if you look at where, so these are phages with 10, 11 genes.
Yeah.
And so you would think if you understood the phage biology reasonably well, you could guess which genes were likely to have the favorable mutations in a given selection. And even there, in the phages, people guess wrong. Now, in the bacteria case, and I think even just digesting maltose, I've forgotten which one they looked at in detail in this group, but there, where they resequenced it, there, and you look at which genes and mutations appeared in, there, even after the fact, it's hard to cook up a story as to why those were the ones which gave selective advantage. It seems to be this affects this, which affects this, which affects this, which gives you 5% fitness advantage. So it's a very complicated.
At least in the context of an artificial expert, you can actually follow how fast those gene frequencies change for every mutation, but because everything's in linkage blocks, things are going up, other things are pitching.
But for the microbes, these ones have done exactly that. They track them.
So for like a complex trait like wound length or something, would you have an intuition how many loci would be, is it 5 or 500 or?
For humans, for height, we know that.
How many?
So if humans, for height, there are 180 or something, and some number like that are known, none of which individually account for more than, I think, about 1%.
Yeah.
But if you take the biggest 30 or something like that, then it accounts for a third of the variance or something like that total between them.
But then each of them is cutting to a lot of other stuff as well, presumably, right? The metabolic.
But the 30, I think, is the level where there's enough data now that there's. That if you measure an individual, that the and you just look at those 30, that you correctly get. I've forgotten it's about a third of the variance in height, but it's large numbers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now there's still debate about that. The resolution on like the number of loci. It's hard to distinguish between 5 or 6, 100 or something like that.
But this
comes typically large.
This comes back to our discussion of the distribution of fitness effects, because there's like if it's many loci, then it would be many with a small fitness effect,
right.
And what we're seeing is the tail, and then there's so maybe the question isn't very well defined because it's sort of there's many but many small ones and a few bigger ones.
But a lot of I think for human genetics, I'm sure people who much more who actually know something about this here. But there were these huge successes initially finding things that were strongly linked with diseases and had a substantial effect on the variance. And the more and more diseases that get looked at, which are known to have family correlations, the fewer and fewer cases there are where you can figure out what's going on. I mean, so they really seem to be, most of these things seem to be multi-locus. And some of the ones like height, I mean, is the quantitative trait is one of the easiest to get things on. But I think even things like bipolar disease, which has been looked at a lot, and they, is known to have very strong family links. And I think there's some particular very rare, forgotten, maybe one very rare gene which does seem to be linked with it. But otherwise, as far as most of the population, it's many, and none of them have particular strong parents, and is almost certainly very many most likely involved.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. You know, if you take a model system and start knowing the mutation. I mean, it seems like it's appealing in the sense that it would be the ultimate experiment along that traditional line of research. But actually, I'm not positive what you learned from.
I mean, I sort of think that the biggest thing you learn is some of these combinatorial questions. I mean, so you can ask a question. So you looked at some things are known about, in a not very novel environment for, bacteria or yeast. How many, or some of the phages, how many mutations are beneficial, at least beneficial by more than a certain amount? If you start looking at the number which are 1% beneficial, then the size experiments, which we can sort of back that out from the experiments, suggest that it's two orders of magnitude larger than what the yeast biologist said it was going to be, who we talked to. But if you can then ask a question, which is, supposing I look at pairs of mutations, and I just ask the question, pairs of mutations which are not beneficial individually, but are beneficial together. And you ask, how many of those are there? Just number. And I would say that's not known to six orders of magnitude. And if you sort of believe the simple the biology of modules, and this interacts with this, and this interacts, you'd expect it to be a relatively small number, because you think it should be sort of two things that have something to do with each other. If you say, if this affects this and this affects this and this affects this, which seems to be the evidence from the single things that people have looked at, then you'd think it's an enormous number potentially there. And that seems to me, there's a dimensionless ratio there which comes in, roughly speaking, which is sort of related to the question of whether mutation rates are large or low, which is related to how many fitness peaks you can explore, which is, has this combinatorial factor coming in? So it's sort of the combinatorial factor times the mutation rate divided by a typical loss of fitness of intermediary or something like that. And I would say that's a number which is not known to many orders of magnitude. And okay. Some of these things we're talking about really start getting at that.
You can learn, I'm wondering where you can learn that.
Absolutely, if you can do it, certainly if you can do enough sequencing. That's prefers to a lot, but it's one where...
Yeah, but I think that's completely agreed. It's one of the main unknowns. Some summary statistic of the amount of interaction on a genome-wide scale. And we're sort of lacking that.
Right. And even there, it's... The problem is, if it's 99.99% in which the combinations are worse than or no better than the individual ones, the problem is for the evolution, it's the other 0.001% that matters in the long run. And so it's one of these things where the extreme, all these things are tails, and that one, unfortunately, is one which is tails as well. And certainly the microbial populations, the microbial populations, I've forgotten the number, everyone in this room within... a year or something like that will explore all simultaneous two-point mutations of their E. coli in their gut. Not just ones with deleterious, with weakly deleterious intermediaries, which are more of those, but the ones with individual will be weakly. And then you start looking at human populations and on timescales in which there's been medicine and so on, and it starts being all 3-point ones. How relevant that is for the evolution of the microbe is not, I think, nobody knows.
Thank you.